Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we're continuing today with the chapter, the marriage of Sukanya and Chavanna Muni. And this is Canto 9, Chapter 3, and the text for today is Text 11. So we can chant responsibly Text 11. Kashachit Vata Kalasyam. Nasyata Vasram Magato. Tau Pujayitva Provacham. Vayo Medatam Ishvarao. Kashyachit Vata Kalasyam. Nasyata Vashramagato. Tau Puja Chitva Pravacham. Vayo Medatam Ishvarao. Kasya Chitvata Kalasyam. Nasyata Vashramagato. Tau Pujaritva Provacha. Vayo Medatam Ishvarao. Please chant. Asya Chitvata Kalasya. Asya Tavashramakato. Tau Pujaitva Provacha. Vayo Medata Mishvaro. Kasya Chitatva Kalasya. Asyata Vashramagatato. Tau Pujaitva Provacha. Vayo Medata Mishvaro. Kavya Chitta Atva Kalasya. Nasyata Vasramagato. Tau Pujaitva Provacha. Vayo Medata Mishvaro. Kasya Chitatva Kalasya. Asya Tatva Shramagato. Tau Pujaitva Provacha. Vayo Medata Mishvaro. Say the word for word. Kashyachit. After some time. Two. But. Ata. In this way. Kalasya. Time having passed. Nasatyao. The two Ashwini Kumaras. Ashrama, that place of Chavanna Muni. Agato, reached. Tau, unto those two. Pujaitva, offering respectful obeisances. Pravacha said, Baya, youth, me, unto me, datam, please, give. Ishvarao, because you too are able to do so. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. Thereafter, some time having passed, the Ashwini Kumara brothers, the heavenly physicians, happened to come to Chyavana Muni's ashram. After offering their respectful obeisances, Chyavana Muni requested them to give him youthful life, for they were able to do so. Purport. The heavenly physicians, like the Ashwini Kumaras, could give youthful life even to one who was advanced in age. Indeed, great yogis, with their mystic powers, can even bring a dead body back to life if the structure of the body is in order. We have already discussed this in connection with Bali Maharaj's soldiers and their treatment by Sukracharya. Modern medical science has not yet discovered how to bring a dead body back to life or bring youthful energy to an old body. But from these verses, we can understand that such treatment is possible if one is able to take knowledge from the Vedic information. The Ashwini Kumaras were expert in Ayurveda, as was Dhanvantari. In every department of material science, there is a perfection to be achieved, and to achieve it, one must consult the Vedic literature. The highest perfection is to become a devotee of the Lord. To attain such this perfection, one must consult Srimad Bhagavatam, which is understood to be the ripe fruit of the Vedic desire tree. Nigama Kalpa Taror Galatim Phalam. Om Gyana Timarandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Ramapada Swami Iti Namine. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Iti Namine. Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Sunyavadi Pashyatya Deshatarine. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Rama Hare Hare. So, in this particular verse, there's a statement that's made by Srila Prabhupada in his purport, and that is that in every department of material science, there's perfection to be achieved, and to achieve it, one must consult the Vedic literature. So there's an implication, and that is that Vedic literature holds that knowledge that allows for perfection to be achieved, whichever the category is of material science. So, of course, Srila Prabhupada adds right at the end of this particular purport that the highest kind of affection, so there's categories of perfection, and the category that's of great importance, that category where one wants to achieve that extreme degree of excellence according to the Vedic standard, is by taking up the science of becoming a devotee of Lord Krishna. And for that to be achieved, one has to consult the Srimad Bhagavatam. So, by way of examining this condition of being perfect, there's an interesting breakdown of persons who come to worship Lord Vamanadev. We read it some time back, who at the time when Lord Vamanadev's glaring effulgence just from his toenail had reduced the effulgence of Lord Brahma's residence. So at that time, in that whole narration, there was a listing of persons who had become perfect. So those personalities, Lord Brahma's associates, they give some indication of the kinds of perfection one can achieve. So there were those who had achieved perfection in self-control and regulative principles. Then there was a different category, those expert in logic, history, general education, and Vedic literatures, such as Kalpa, that's the literature that's dealing with historical incidents. And there were those, a different category, that were expert in the Vedic corollaries, such as Brahma Samhita or the other Vedas such as the Samayaru, Rig, and Atharva Veda, and also the supplementary Vedic knowledge. So it seemed that they were being bunched together. Those who had knowledge of Ayurved or Dhanurveda. And other kinds of perfection was present in a category of persons that were Lord Brahma's associates, and those were those that were freed from reaction by virtue of their transcendental knowledge, which they'd awakened by yoga practice. And others in the same category of persons with Lord Brahma's associates, they'd become perfect due to their advanced Vedic knowledge, and this was what had allowed them to become residents of Brahmaloka. So these were, it's kind of like painting the picture of, you know, perfection in different categories, because I'm just highlighting Srila Prabhupada pointing out that, you know, perfection can be achieved in different areas of material science. But all of that perfection is achieved with consulting the Vedic literatures. So, but in that particular narration, it's Lord Brahma who takes the role of offering prayers to Lord Vamanadev. But the entire group, his associates, they all take part in collecting the paraphernalia that's going to be used to worship Lord Vamanadev, to please him. So it gives some indication that there's transcendental knowledge that comes with consulting the Vedas in the different areas of material science. So if we were to examine some of these categories, so I thought I'd go through it because it's kind of interesting. If we were to examine the perfection that's achieved by those who are practicing self-control, then and they were following regulative principles, we learn that this process of perfection entails disregarding material enjoyment. So what this translates into is that those persons are acting in perfecting a particular thought process. And the thought process is thinking of oneself as a divided part of the Lord, but also something that's part of the composition of the Lord. So Srila Prabhupada often uses that word, part and parcel. So this cultivation of this kind of thinking in this category of persons that are practicing self-control and pushing away sense gratification is kind of that picture of themselves perfecting the thought process is also given by Krishna from a different angle. And we find it in Bhagavad Gita 10:39, where Krishna says to Arjuna, "Arjuna, I'm the generating seed of all existence. There's no being moving or non-moving that can exist without me." So this kind of understanding that the persons who are practicing self-control or regulative principles are coming to, it becomes enhanced, their thinking becomes enhanced if they start thinking that without Krishna's energy, nothing can exist. And that without his spiritual strength or his potency, nothing, even unmoving, never mind moving objects, none of them can exist. So I'll read that particular Sanskrit as well. Yachapi sattva bhutanam bijam tad aham Arjuna na tad asti vina yatsyam maya bhutam characharan. So that category of persons that are cultivating the thinking that their being would not existing would not be able to be functioning or moving without Krishna's potency or his creation. They are persons that come to a certain understanding, and there's an implication for cultivating that kind of thinking. They come to understand that actually they have no right to enjoy the result of their work. And that result should be enjoyed by the person who's their origin, so the Supreme Lord. So this act of thinking moves in the direction of a certain kind of perfection. So the perfection with cultivating that kind of thought process is that pleasure starts to be taken not from anything material, but rather pleasure comes from the transcendental happiness of performing service to the Supreme Lord. So that's the perfection. The perfection is the increasing reliance on transcendental happiness versus looking for happiness in the material realm. Then, in the category of those who achieve perfection through logic and history, one can understand that it's natural that those persons only want to accept that can be proved through logic or reasoning or argument. And it's a fact that without logical reasoning, it's very difficult to accept the absolute truth. So Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he gives an explanation of how there's an obstruction in understanding the absolute truth. So these are his words. "Spiritual activities retain their uncontaminated transcendental character even when they choose to appear to the view of people of this world apparently in the identical form of the events of this world. The impression that is naturally received by the conditioned soul from the experience of such manifestation of such spiritual events does not appear as that of transcendence to the mundane aptitude of the persons experiencing the same." This is actually from an essay he wrote entitled "Erotic Principles and Unalloyed Devotion." So he's pointing to the fact that something that's transcendental, because the perception is mundane, is not that the transcendental activity is not transcendental, but the aptitude of the person is on a mundane level. So to them, it appears mundane because they labeling something transcendental within their known realm, a mundane realm. So they're not actually accessing the transcendental aspect of the particular spiritual activity. So there's, so naturally, you know, the question is, persons that are trying to achieve perfection through logic and reasoning, how do they actually get entrance into the transcendental realm, or the aptitude, so to speak, as Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, how does it shift from looking from in a kind of mundane way to actually being able to see, you know, more with spiritual vision? So there's a test, so to speak, that is proposed by Krishnadas Kaviraj. You find this in Adi Leela 8:15. And this is what he proposes to the persons that are attempting to, you know, come to the absolute truth through logic and reasoning. If you are indeed interested in logic and argument, kindly apply it to the mercy of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. If you do so, you'll find it strikingly wonderful. So this is how he proposes the test. So, Srila Prabhupada, I guess, kind of brings to, down to earth that particular test that he puts out to those that are looking with logic and argument. And he notes that intelligence is required to be able to apply logic and argument, particularly when it's being applied to a very subtle understanding of transcendental spiritual, something that's of a transcendental spiritual substance. Because remember, logic and argument, it's very much grounded in words, ideas, and then how does one actually shift it to that transcendental spiritual substance? So Srila Prabhupada's pointing to the intelligence. So some spiritual intelligence is required, and at that time, when persons are applying their, you know, sort of word, idea, logic, argument, if they will come to understand that knowledge on the basis of material logic actually can't help one to understand the absolute truth. It doesn't quite fit. And so Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, he points to the act that's necessary for coming to perfection through for the logicians, and that is that they need to put Lord Chaitanya's mercy to the test. This is the only test, and this is what actually allows for that shift or coming to that conclusion that's correct from the spiritual standpoint. It actually can't be achieved through logic. And why this test is put out to logicians by Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami is that there's no personality that's more merciful than Lord Chaitanya. Therefore, it will be more palpable, that transcendental spiritual substance, the mercy that's coming, the ability to have spiritual intellect. So, there's a second test that's put out by Krishnadas Goswami to logicians who are wanting to move towards some perfection in their science of logic and argument, but, you know, if they're attempting to move towards the absolute truth. And he says that one needs to compare the results of humanitarian work with the results of Lord Chaitanya's merciful activities. And if their judgment is impartial, then it's possible to understand that no other humanitarian activity can surpass that of Lord Chaitanya. And by logic, if we look at it by logic, everybody's engaged in some humanitarian activity. Like the other morning, there's one of the local street persons, you know, sitting on the bench in front, and he's well trained in persons performing humanitarian activity, and he's expecting to be the recipient of such humanitarian activity. So immediately he spots I'm wearing some sort of knitted hat. So he says to me, "Do I have a knitted hat for him?" So, you know, he's well conditioned to knowing that persons are always performing some humanitarian activity. He had no qualms to just ask. You know, so he's already knows that people perform humanitarian work. So. But humanitarian work generally is engaged on the basis of the body. So just like that man, he's expecting, and he told me why the hat should be given. I can put it here to be warm. So it's on the basis of the body. And of course, since we know that the body is ultimately subject to destruction, looking ahead, those humanitarian activities merely lead one to accept another body on the basis of those activities that are performed. So in some sense, one is locked into a certain corporal reality through those humanitarian activities. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philanthropic activities are performed in connection to the soul. Because he imparted spiritual advancement to purify the existential condition of humanity. And he put into practice, you could say, a particular instruction of Lord Krishna. The material body of the indestructible, immeasurable, eternal living entity is sure to come to an end. Therefore, fight, O descendant of Bharata. And that's what Lord Chaitanya was doing. He was actually engaging in this glorious fight to purify the existential condition of humanity. And he was giving that love of Krishna, which is the means for the perfection, the purification, without discrimination. So there's no comparison. I mean, the simple hat for warmth, versus, you know, the entire existential reality benefiting of, you know, one's understanding who one actually is in relation to the absolute truth. So for those following the process of perfecting or perfection in the supplementary knowledge of Ayurveda, there's again that moving towards perfection, but it rests on the understanding of the Vedanta Sutras that the living entity has qualities of light because he's part and parcel of the Supreme Light. So that's usually the basis for persons who are trying to achieve perfection in Ayurveda. And this is analogous to the sunlight maintains the entire universe. So the light of the soul maintains the material body. So persons who are moving towards perfection in Ayurveda, they have this as their fundamental understanding. Now, I have a personal experience. There's a doctor I didn't see very often, but for many, many, many years I've taken just a little bit of his formulations, and recently he left his body, in fact, about a week ago. And I thought, well, he's a very perfect example of somebody who attempted to pursue perfection through, you know, the study of the Vedas and particularly the Ayurvedic portion. He would always cite the Charak Samhita, and he, I thought I'd look at, you know, what he communicated, because he used to teach a lot. So one of the things he would communicate a great deal was, you know, we read the term samadhi and we think of it differently from how he's explaining it, but this is the Ayurvedic portion of the Vedas, and this is what they explain of samadhi. Sama is being equal in the distribution of, and D is buddhi or intellect. So he specifically studied mano buddhi, so intellect connected to the mind, and sattva buddhi or spiritual intellect. And he looked at the coordination between the two, so the coordination between the mind and the light of the soul. And he's working from the Vedic texts. He was very, the family lineage is, apparently they treated Krishna's family as the whole lineage is traced back. So he's making the distinction between the logical aspect of the intellect, the mano buddhi, and the spiritual intellect. And being a physician, so here's somebody who achieved that kind of perfection in Ayurveda, he specifically created treatments that dealt with the disruption of that samadhi, the coordination between the mano buddhi and the sattva buddhi, or the logical intellect or some intellect in the mind versus spiritual intellect. So, and he listed, and I thought this was very interesting, he lists specific things that disrupt that coordination between the two. So this is some of his listing. As I said, it's a person who taught a great deal. So he listed environmental disturbances that affect the prana or the life force. And so those environmental disturbances affect the body's pranic health. Another problem in that coordination between the sattva buddhi and the mano buddhi is the improper flow of prana within the body's micro and macro channels, which results in a lack of communication between the mano buddhi and the sattva buddhi, and or the subtle bodies. And he also pointed to unresolved past grief and trauma, which results in the lack of coordination between the mind and the body and the heart lotus, which is the seat of the sattva or the soul, or in his case, he called it that, and current mental stresses, which distract the mind and prevent it going towards finer states of inner awareness and bliss. And finally, he looked at how the distracted nature of the senses, which interfere with the mind's communication with the sattva. So as a physician and somebody who had that perfection in Ayurveda, these were disturbances that he identified. So he specifically created formulations that dealt with all those categories of disturbance between the mind and the soul, basically, or the subtle body, some lack of coordination between the subtle body and its connection to spiritual intellect. So, and in this particular verse today, and I went into detail about this because in this particular verse today, the highlight is the Ashwini Kumaras who do the difficult task. So they've perfected Ayurveda. They have to give youth to one who's in an advanced age. That was the request of Chavana Muni. So I looked at, since this is my personal experience and I haven't studied the Ayurvedic texts, so I looked at this practitioner because having had personal experience of the balance that comes from the formulations he had made, I looked at some of the things he's written about. And from his study of the Charak Samhita, he points to certain herbs and spices that are actually divine because they create that balanced chemistry which attunes the body to more refined states of consciousness. And just being in a more refined state of consciousness through the usage of these divine herbs and spices, it prevents the regular degeneration of the body. So I don't know how it works, but this is just his part. In our verse today, the Ashwini Kumaras, they actually take Chavana Muni into a river. So the idea of particular herbs and spices being divine, that they prevent the regular degeneration of the body. I'm making a connection that somehow their knowledge, water molecules, something that's in the water, that it actually brings regeneration to those cells, in the same way that this particular practitioner of Ayurveda was able to prevent the degeneration of the body and allow for this very subtle coordination in the subtle body to be very smooth. So too, it doesn't seem so unusual that it's possible to bring about regeneration of a very old body, especially a body like Chavanamuni, who's already attained very a subtle state of consciousness. So it seems very natural for Chavanamuni to request the Ashwini Kumaras to give him a youthful life, because he knows they can achieve it because of their perfection in the study of Ayurveda. Now, because today is also the Sita Devi's disappearance day, I thought to make a connection, because this whole verse deals with Ayurveda and the Ashwini Kumaras. I drew something from Sita Devi and how she actually had some insight into the subtle workings of the body in relation to the elements. So I'm going to read. This comes from a book called Shadows of the Sun Dynasty, which takes a very a personal approach according to the personality, like something of their thinking is brought out. So I'm going to read a little bit of Sita Devi, and I'm connecting it to this whole topic of Ayurveda. So there's an incident which illustrates something of the interplay between the mind and the body elements. Ram tells Sita that he's leaving Ayodhya to honor his father's promise. So he offers many arguments to Sita. He tells her, this is all in favor of leaving her behind. So he tells her, the forest is dangerous, women don't live there, they're blood drinkers who live in the forest, there are other predators, in fact they're numerous, and he also tells her he could never forgive himself if anything were to happen to her. So this is, these are all arguments he's presenting to leave her behind. But she doesn't care at all for any of the arguments. And what happens to her is a terrible and unspeakable anger takes hold of her. So she pushes the anger down and intuiting something of the power of the anger. So she looks at Lord Ram and just the tip of her fury spills out. And she says these words, "You are the cruelest, most hard-hearted person I have ever met. Those who praise your kindness are fools. You have tied me to you with the deepest bonds of love. Now that I depend on you and need you, you have abandoned me." So these were her words to Lord Ram. So then the description goes on, Sita's finding it unbearable, the thought of this separation. So that spark in her core turned into fire. Sita trembled, but felt an immediate restraint and caution. Her emotions and thoughts had the power to transform the earth. If she trembled like this, the earth would quake in response. She severed her connection to her mortal frame and was cast away into darkness. Her frightened spirit flew up into the void. So I'm going to read this next part as well. The great mother rushed up towards her and caught hold of her spirit, bringing it back down to earth and then below its surface. The moment the goddess held her, this is goddess Bhumi, she knew her mother. Mother, Sita cried out, but not in her earthly voice. She was not in that body. The mother here was not the mother Sita shared with Urmila, her little sister. This mother was more visceral to her. She was like Sita. They were one of a kind. Wrapped in the great mother's warmth, she felt all the elements within her harmonize and come alive. Goddess Bhumi was made of the material elements. Earth, water, fire, air, and ether were her form, as was Sita. The elements were extensions of her being, as strong as arms, limbs, and thoughts were to a human body. It was not with human eyes that Sita looked at her mother. Those eyes were left behind on the surface of the earth, where Sita knew that she had fainted, closing her eyes to the reality before her, a life without Ram. So this is the description given. So I just made a connection because Sita had that experience of connecting with Goddess Bhumi and realizing that she herself had the same elements of earth, water, fire, air, and ether as was the composition of Goddess Bhumi. So I just thought it made a nice connection with Ayurveda. And since today we're honoring Sita, it kind of connected to the verse in this way. Now, finally, there's that category of persons who achieve perfection having awakened to transcendental knowledge, which brings an end to any fruitive activities or fruitive reactions in particular. That was in the listing of those personalities, those associates of Lord Brahma. So this is explained by Krishna. I'll read from Bhagavad Gita 4:42. Yoga samyasta karmanam, gyana sanchina samsayam, atma vantam na karmani, vidabhananti dananjaya. One who acts in devotional service, renouncing the fruits of his action, and whose doubts have been destroyed by transcendental knowledge, is situated factually in the self. Thus, he's not bound by the reactions of work, O conqueror of riches. So, this brings us full circle in the discussion. Back to Srila Prabhupada's statement that one needs to consult the Srimad Bhagavatam. And of course, in this case, I'm consulting Bhagavad Gita to come to the highest perfection, and that is of becoming a devotee of the Lord. And the result is given by Krishna, what transpires when one consults Bhagavad Gita or Srimad Bhagavatam. And it's given by Lord Krishna in this verse that I read, that just through consulting those transcendental literatures and following their instruction, one becomes free from any doubts about the existence of the Absolute Truth, the mercy coming from the Absolute Truth by the grace of transcendental knowledge. So that is what allows for that proper understanding that one's a part and parcel of Lord Krishna, that mercy coming through the instruction. And this is what establishes one or in self-knowledge. And that's what allows one to be completely outside that normal bondage of reaction for actions that one's performing. So these were some thoughts on this verse today, in its, I guess, fairly straightforward idea that was presented. So if there's any thought on it to expand our discussion.
There's some thoughts of hearing a little bit about Ayurveda. My thought is that I see it as very useful, especially attending to like the instructions of like performing our prescribed duty if we're not completely renounced or on that level of Krishna consciousness to renounce the material necessities, to learn about Ayurveda, to learn about different things that are useful for staying in the mode of goodness, like Hatha Yoga, or like learning healthy, like food production. That's a big thing. But I guess I'm wondering how we can focus on that, or if it's recommended, because there's not a whole lot of instruction from Prabhupada of like how to develop like a really motive goodness, like occupation, like occupational duty. Whereas, so then we see a lot of people just working ordinary jobs rather than really focusing on like awesome motive goodness, things that we can do on the material platform to maintain our bodies in the mode of goodness, maintain our life in the mode of goodness. So I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
The thought that was expressed was that you were expressing, Giridhari Prabhu, was that you can see the usefulness of looking at or even learning some practices that are conducive to the mode of goodness, because one's understanding there's certain necessities that come with the body. So you were saying you could see the advantage perhaps even of learning Hatha Yoga, or even you pointed to food production. So you were wondering if there's some thoughts on how to move towards those, or particularly the two mode of goodness practices that you'd identified. And I take it you were particularly pointing to occupation, so maybe the food production was one you wanted a closer look at, because you understand that if you observe the regular society of devotees, there's a job being maintained that's not necessarily in accord with that kind of sattvic behavior. Yeah, it's very interesting, the thought you've expressed and the observation you've made. It comes to mind immediately that some devotees I've been exposed to of more recent times are holding corporate jobs. And corporate jobs means that one is in an office somewhere, working for a company where one may not be directly performing the activities, but the activities performed by that corporation, what they translate into often are very destructive, hellish kind of activities. So I'm going to give two examples that come to mind. So these are devotees sitting in an office doing, I don't know, whatever corporate persons do, coordinate some things between departments, maybe look at finances, maybe a lot of coordination, no doubt. So one such devotee was doing work for and corporate work for an organization that, or a corporation that promotes the meat industry. So he's not directly there on the floor in some abattoir, you know, where poor cows are coming on a conveyor belt and somebody's like, you know, got X amount of time to remove the skin of the animal and, you know, sever the various parts of the body. So that person in the corporate office is not doing that activity, but the person is indirectly supporting that. So I'm very much taking your statement and expanding on it, that it practically is a reality that the jobs held are not necessarily sattvic, even if the person is not directly you know, performing the grossest activity. It's supporting and working for that corporation. Then there's another devotee who, again, it's a corporate job, so coordination, planning, managing things. But the corporation is, I guess it must be the McDonald's thing. It's a meat industry again. So the person is not there actually taking portions of the slaughtered animal's limbs and, you know, shaping it into something that to persons who are accustomed to that form of sustenance find attractive, you know, that instead of it being a limb, it's shaped into a circular form that appears attractive to somebody. So that person's not doing that, but the person is managing things, facilitating the all the elements that allow for that final act of consumption. So, indeed, the jobs are not sattvic at all, even though the blood is not touched. So, you pointed to food production, and Srila Prabhupada actually was indicating an agrarian society. So sometimes I find myself when I'm walking around the city, I think it is so extremely artificial that so much work is completely removed from the source of one's sustenance. So, you know, even the fact that one goes to a grocery store and you see persons carrying, like, and I find myself in the same situation, carrying, you know, two or three bags, you know, with apples that came from some distant trees in Washington, some mangoes that, you know, come from a distant continent, Mexico. You know, I mean, it's very odd. And so it seems very sensible and truly simple to, or a much more simplified lifestyle that you can grow your necessities. So one may not be able to grow mango depending on where one lives, but one can certainly cultivate vegetables seasonally. I mean, grains, I recall asking this question when we were purchasing a house in Naperville. I realized that it had been farmland, and probably, you know, 40 years ago, because most of our towns, you know, just 40 years ago, they were actually rural and they were being cultivated. The land was being cultivated, and I touched the soil of that house and I saw it was, you know, that rich loamy soil that obviously would be tremendous for growing. So I asked the realtor, I said, oh, you know, this used to be farmland, you know, perhaps it's possible to plant something. So the person looked at me and said, no, I don't think a cornfield can be planted. Meant that it's not even viewed favorably, that one should actually be growing a crop in one's backyard. So, you know, this shows that this kind of dissociation from the reality that it is possible to grow a certain amount of vegetables, plants that can be used for personal consumption. And I mean, Srila Prabhupada rests everything on the having a cow, because there's an interplay between the growth of those crops and the manure from the cow, and the diet then is perfectly rounded. There's the grain, the vegetables, fruit, and the milk products from the cow. So everything is works harmonious, both internally for the body and externally how nature, even though you are utilizing nature, so to speak, it's not that the crops would be naturally there, it's still done in a very balanced way through the presence of a cow. This is how Srila Prabhupada has explained it and how I've understood it. So if the reality is not such that one's in a rural area, but one's in a suburb, I mean, one can certainly grow vegetables and have a fruit tree. And so actually for quite a long section of the year, one can actually harvest those. And if one becomes very expert, one knows which thing matures at a certain time. So one does it sequentially so that, you know, this particular plant or the fruits or vegetables this season or this time period is over. Now the next, that plant has this nature that will give its fruits or vegetables at that time. So you do it sequentially. So it is possible. I mean, it requires obviously quite a bit of intelligence and I guess some training in how to do it. There's a devotee who supplies flowers to all our temples, and he's had this long-term plan to, instead of all these flowers being doused with chemicals to make sure that, you know, they produce so that it can be exported, because it's a business. So you have to force and make sure that everything is perfect and on time. You know, you can't allow nature to take its course. So everything's doused in chemicals, and you find the persons who handle those flowers making garlands for the deities, they're always having rashes because of the chemicals. So he's had a long-term plan to have land and begin growing flowers. So I don't know how that progresses, but he has had training, like several years his studying was in agriculture or food production. So one can get some training, or I think universities offer courses that don't have to be part of a whole long commitment on producing this, that, or the other. I've attended some of those. Once I got a grant because of doing some teaching work, so I used it to take some of those courses on growing things. And then there's a devotee who's trying to do it in an organized way, I think Abhiram Prabhu, where he actually has some kind of farmland on the perimeter of New York. And he is attempting to provide that kind of training that devotees can come there and actually learn food production. So he's trying to make it a reality. So, and he spoke about it in one seminar at Gita Nagari, how he was attempting to go about that. And then because this society is still functioning on, you know, the ready-made, the grocery bags filled with what you're going to eat, bought from the supermarket. He had somebody come, I think, to that seminar in Gita Nagari, where the person spoke about the particular things that had been grown in that farmland with devotees by Abhiram, that he was then marketing some things, I think like muffins or something like that. This person was obviously a business-minded person, and that was then being put out into the regular society that gets ready-made things. But at least, you know, it's all coming directly from the earth, very clean, all the particular products. So those are some thoughts, and at least the devotees looking seriously into providing or giving others access to some training to in food production, because indeed that's one of the tenets in Ayurveda. Like there's a whole listing, just like basic regulations that should be followed to maintain good health. And one very important one is that everything one eats should be freshly cooked. So never mind that the ingredients should be fresh and without pesticides, because that's exactly what causes the chemicals, is what caused the some disruption in the micro channels. You know, chemicals are being then fed to all the organs. So naturally there's going to be disruption in harmonizing the mind and, you know, trying to go internally and meditate on Lord Krishna and becoming more aware. It's naturally going to be inhibited because all the organs are being fed little bits of chemical. So yeah, it has big implications. So thank you for that particular observation, and that it allowed for some thought on the implication.
Hare Krishna, thank you for your class. One point you made is that you distinguish between our happiness should only come from transcendental happiness you were making, and our happiness should have come from happiness on the outside. Always quoted that verse, quote, it says, life is like a poker game. We can't change the cards we're dealt, just how we play the hand. And it's just an appreciation of a Sukanya. She had the worst possible hand. She got a husband that was really, you know, like a million years old. And she should have been the one that was irritable, but she wasn't. She got the worst possible hand. And we can see in poker, even if you get the worst possible hand, you would still win if you're patient, enthusiastic, act like you have the best hand, and she did. And I guess that's why Subal mentioned the other day she was considered great. So my question is related to that point, is that we all want the best hand. We're trying to be Krishna. Krishna he's happy because everything goes his way. He's a controller. And so Shivanas, you know, he wanted everything to go his way. I want youth for life. And now, as practicing devotees, we may not ask for youth or clothes or things, but still we also ask Krishna, please, I just want you to control my senses. I want the transcendental happiness. And sometimes, doesn't matter how much you pray to Krishna, sometimes he gives you the inspiration to control your senses, and sometimes not. So my question is related to the fact that my understanding is that sometimes it may be considered a blessing when we, like, suppose somebody insults you. It's hard to control your thoughts. Beep, 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 beep. That's all, your thoughts is welling off, or you can't control your lust. And the reason I appreciate that is because I'll just mention one pastime, maybe you could expand on that. And the reason, there's one pastime in 11th canto of the Uddhava Gita where it's explained that there was a king named King Puruvava. And he had the realization, he came to this realization on his own from his embarrassing mistakes. He said essentially in this pastime that I was very proud to be a king. Now, king means lord, master, the controller. But he's like, although I was very proud to be the master, the controller, it was saying that I was actually being controlled by a heavenly damsel or Vashi, because long story short, you know, basically there's a saying, hit it and quit it. Usually guys have sex with a girl and then leave her. But this is a reverse pastime where she, you know, he engaged in sex for many years and then she left him. He was devastated, so he left out of his palace and naked, nude, and was begging for her to take him back. And he was like, he gained the realization that I thought I'm the controller, but actually I'm a slave or Vashi. So we see in the material world that I'm asking you, is it considered a blessing that suppose we're a leader of any institution or a king, we may say it's my duty to enforce these rules and regulations. I'm the controller, it's my duty. But then we become controlled by yamonia or some type of sickness or our senses, and then we're not present here. So how do we consider it a blessing that it's actually a blessing that sometimes Krishna doesn't give us the ability to control our thoughts, because that gives us the opportunity to apologize, to be more humble. So how can we see that as a blessing instead of seeing it as a curse and becoming unenthusiastic about spiritual life? Like, Krishna, I'm praying to you so much, you know. I'm not asking you for things, I'm asking you for spiritual happiness. Help me control my senses, but you're not doing it. And so that's the tendency. When we're able to perfectly control our senses, we may think we deserve some honor and some respect. I'm the controller. So how can we see that as a blessing and to remain determined and enthusiastic? Like, so, because mostly I used to think it was a curse, like, you know, Krishna, you know, I'm praying for you for spiritual happiness, to control my thoughts, control my senses, but sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't. So how do we see that as a blessing so we won't be, so we can remain determined in spiritual life?
So Jai Baladev, you were particularly focusing on the point that a I think what I brought up was that persons who are practicing self-control and regulative principles, they come to an understanding that happiness is to be found in transcendence as opposed to something material. So you particularly moved from that point to your final question through the diversion of King Pururava and his dealing with sexual desire, and you moved to the question of if one has difficulty controlling one's thoughts, but one thinks that or one prays to Krishna that he control one's thoughts, and you also brought up maybe difficulty even control lusty desires, then how can one be in that state of accepting I guess of one's condition in some sense, and of also knowing that sometimes there's that spiritual happiness and sometimes not, because of the difficulty of controlling the thoughts. Well, a lot of, self-control goes along with following the regulative principles. So, so by following those regulative principles, it's automatically not taking one into external behavior that is contrary to religious principles. So if one's automatically, by following those regulative principles, not going into dangerous area, then automatically one is protected from the suffering that would come from going into dangerous area by breaking those regulative principles. And suffering usually takes the form of mental distress. There's a lot of mental distress. There may be physical harm that comes to you as a reaction, but certainly there's mental, emotional distress. That's a reaction to not following the regulative principles. So, for instance, if one is indulging in intoxicants, or if one is indulging in pursuing sexual pleasure, or so, because those are the two that you brought up. So, now if the mind, if one is following the regulative principles, one's not going into dangerous areas that wouldn't automatically bring huge mental suffering, so definitely disarray of thoughts and just mental disturbance. But one is finding that thoughts still show some disturbance, then, you know, how is one going to deal with that? So you mentioned, utilizing prayer. The other thing that certainly brings the mind under control is the sound vibration of Krishna's holy name. The mind gets settled. So again, that the sadhana practice of chanting subdues the mind. So then what happens through chanting, one discovers that the mind actually has a certain pattern. Some detachment comes, so one can actually observe the mind a little bit. And then when one observes the mind, meaning all those thought patterns, one discovers there's a pattern. And that pattern is cyclical. So for a certain period of time, one will be happy. And there'll be a certain period of time where one will be a little bit down. And it follows the cycle. You start to recognize it after some time. So because there's karma one's carrying. So that karma is kind of mirrored in the, I guess, the suffering or the pattern of suffering that's there. So one recognizes that one has got this body, one has got those karmic reactions, but because one is practicing abstaining from any of those irreligious acts that would break the regulative principles, and is enhancing everything through the purifying, what should be the word, the purifying actions, particularly eating of sanctified foodstuffs, you know, feeding the auditory channels with the holy name, and even the external activity that acts of sacrifice are performed, that's a form of self-control, because one is always choosing the act of sacrifice. So, like, I know you like to sit and play the harmonium and do a kirtan for the deity. So that those acts of sacrifice and the external acts that are purifying acts of taking prasadam or having the vibration of the holy name into the auditory channel, all those subdue the mind. The mind can't, it doesn't, even though it's got its pattern, and it may be a disjointed, mixed up pattern because of past reaction to past transgression of religious principles, it gets subdued, and one just tolerates what some of those patterns are there. Because all one's current activities are not bringing more disturbance. It's right, just there's the existing disturbance, and all one's current activities are keeping at bay anything else. So then that disturbance that's there, one recognizes as belonging to the past, and one also can choose to work with it sometimes. Sometimes one may need psychological help to work with it. but at least one can recognize it's not in the present. It belongs to the past. It's the result of previous, it's a reaction from previous activities. At least in the present, I'm moving forward. And I'm not adding to the existing burden. There's none of that. One is safe. So it's a consolation, because whatever that disturbance, the scattered thoughts, it's from before. So that's a consolation. Thank you. Hare Krishna. So thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.